You're with Truth News Radio Australia on the 28th of March, 2015. My name's Hereward Fenton. Great to be with you today, folks. In today's show, I'm going to be focusing on the issue of metadata retention, which, of course, is a big subject in Australia right now with the passing of new federal legislation, which has been very controversial in this country, but has finally now been passed as law. And I'm going to look at this from a few different angles, and I want to try and clarify some of the more obscure facts about this that I think a lot of people don't really understand. And the most interesting of which, I think, is that the new laws that are being brought in really actually don't significantly change the status quo from what it already is. But that's not a good thing. I think the new laws actually have brought awareness to the fact that the government agencies, in fact more than 80 of them, have been able to, for a very long time, access this metadata information from ISPs without a warrant. And this is quite extraordinary because this information is actually quite sensitive. It's very detailed. It gives you a lot of very detailed information about who contacted who, when, where, you know, what time. And there are so many scenarios where the leaking of that information could have significant implications for people for business reasons or for legal reasons that are certainly not to do with criminal matters, but could be construed as that by a corrupt agency wanting to get that information to get an advantage over someone for whatever reason. And there are endless scenarios that you can imagine that might involve the improper access of that information. But what's most important to understand is that the new legislation that has been brought forth is simply now making it an official requirement of ISPs to record the data that most of them were recording anyway and which the government already had access to. Now, this actually gives the government a considerable advantage in pitching the new laws by arguing that they're not really gaining powers that they didn't already have. And they're also now touting the fact that the number of agencies that are able to access that information has actually been vastly reduced. So they're able to pitch this new legislation as actually an improvement for your protection, an improvement for your privacy. And so, folks, I'm not an advocate of the government's legislation, but it's really important to understand what exactly is going on. And I'm going to just play to you now a clip from a recent interview with Senator George Brandis. And this was also in the context of another very important heated topic, which I'm going to get into in a lot more detail in this show because it's very important. And this is the amendments to the bill that allegedly provide protections to journalists. And we put that term in quotes because we have to, you know, define what is a journalist for that to be meaningful. But there are new protections that have been granted that were not available before to journalists to protect their metadata so that it's not possible to simply go and grab it as they can with, you know, ordinary mere citizens like myself, who probably isn't construed as a journalist, but we'll get on to that shortly. Let me just first play to you the recent interview with George Brandis, which was conducted on ABC Radio. Here we go.
The Attorney General George Brandis joins me in the studio. Good morning, Senator Brandis.
Good morning, Mike.
Why would the government need to go after journalist sources even with a warrant?
Well, the government doesn't intend to go after journalist sources. That is not what this is about. The reason the government has accommodated the Labor Party's wishes here, which were raised very late in the piece, I might say, and after the matter had been thoroughly looked at not once but twice by the Parliament's Intelligence Committee, is merely to remove an obstacle which had been thrown up at the last minute by the Labor Party to getting bipartisan support. This has never been about journalists. What this has been about is creating a statutory obligation to retain metadata, which is already retained by telecommunications companies, but which, with changing technology, changing billing practices, was no longer being retained. So an existing investigative capability was being degraded.
Well, why not give...
I'm just going to pause it there. I just want to comment on the question about journalist sources, because the legislation amendments do protect journalists from random, non-warrant access of metadata, but they don't protect journalists from warrants. And so warrants can still be issued against journalists. And the reason for this, of course, would be to get information about a journalist's source. So in the initial thrust of the question there was, why would the government be interested in getting the source of a journalist? Well, of course, we know that they're very interested in that, and they certainly haven't lost the capability to do that. But the interview now really concerns more the question of the main provisions of the new Act and the fact, as Senator Brandis said there, that that they're really only sort of formalising what they already were able to do. So just continuing now with the interview.
Journalists an exemption then?
I don't think journalists should be above the law, but that having been said, we have recognised for some time in this country now that the protection of journalist sources is something that the law ought to acknowledge. So what we don't think that this was really necessary, because as I said in answer to your earlier question, this was never about journalists. This was about law enforcement and national security. But in order to put minds at rest, that this could affect journalists, we have agreed to create a limited exemption in relation to them.
OK, the MEAA, the Journalists' Union, says that even with the changes, the law still permits an outrageous attack on press freedom.
That is outrageous hyperbole. Well, there is no... Let me address what the MEAA has said. This law does not change the status quo. That's the first point to be made. Telecommunications companies have always retained this information. It has always been accessible to ASIO, to state and federal law enforcement authorities without warrant. At heart, all this legislation does is to mandate the continuation of the status quo, but it also builds in new protections, new privacy protections that weren't there in the aren't part of the existing law. Let me mention three of them. First of all, the number of agencies, the number of government bodies that can get access to metadata has been reduced from some 80 to about 20. So it is now limited only to ASIO, the police forces, state corruption bodies, and the three big economic regulators, the ACCC, ASIC, and the ATO. Secondly, we've discussed the new protection for journalists that is not part of the existing law. And thirdly, under the legislation that the government seeks to pass this fortnight, there is a new oversight power held by the Commonwealth Ombudsman that wasn't there under the pre-existing law. So these are three new privacy measures that weren't part of the pre-existing law.
But you can still get a warrant to get access to journalist metadata, can't you?
At the moment, you don't need a warrant to do that.
No, but essentially you will be able to get one, which might be too difficult.
And in the unlikely event that such a warrant was sought, there are protections built into the legislation to protect the journalist source. But I come back to my initial proposition. I don't think many people in the community would say that journalists should be entirely immune from criminal law investigation, so that in the unlikely event a journalist or the source of a journalist were actually involved in the commission of a crime, of course they should
certainly
be able to be
pursued. I don't think the media alliance is arguing
in the quote you just gave me seemed to say there should be a blanket exemption.
But,
of course there shouldn't be a blanket exemption.
Why not consider some provisions such as the ones that the US has put in place where warrants are only issued as a last resort after all other options have been exhausted and media organisations have been given an opportunity to argue before a judge.
Okay, I'll just leave it there. The main point I want to follow up on this subject is this question about the protection of journalists, because the definition of a journalist, you understand, is something that is not universally known or accepted. Now, it turns out that the government's recognition of what is journalism is actually quite restrictive. Now, I want to read to you from an article in The Guardian, which addresses this tricky concept of defining journalism. What is a journalist? Trying to define journalism in law is not an easy task. The craft has taken on an increasingly amorphous form, and the first response to the Prime Minister's concession on metadata has been for people to ask who would be entitled to protection. Some of the questions being thrown around have included, are bloggers journalists? Do people need to be paid professionally? And would an isolated act of journalism, say publishing a bunch of documents on a website for the purposes of the public understanding an issue better, be enough to gain protection? Many courts have tried to define journalism, even looking back almost a century ago. In an early US Supreme Court case, the court considered whether a woman who was pamphleting without permission should be issued the same form of protection as the press. The court said in its judgment that the press, in its historic connotation, comprehends every sort of publication which affords a vehicle of information and opinion. Australia grappled with this issue when it changed the Evidence Act 1995 to enhance shield protection for journalists. This says a journalist is anyone who is engaged and active in the publication of news and who may be given information by an informant in the expectation that the information may be published in a news medium. Now, in the context of these new laws and the specific protections for so-called journalists, it appears from the data I've gleaned that, in fact, the definition is much more restrictive. And I've got an article here from theconversation.com, and I don't have the exact legislation in front of me. I do apologise. I wish I had that, and I could then maybe give you a more detailed appraisal of it. But the assessment here from another news article on the piece says that in the amendments adopted by the House of Representatives, it seems that only professional journalists will benefit from the warrant process. It does not adequately protect all those receiving information or publishing news, particularly in light of many people beyond those employed by traditional media organisations using social media to perform these tasks in the public interests. Also, a journalist would never know whether an application has been made to access the retained data. And we are just going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm going through some of the thorny issues in relation to Australia's new metadata laws. So do stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And today I'm talking about the new data retention laws in Australia. trying to get to the core of it, you know, trying to really understand what we need to be concerned about, what's important, because a lot of it is stuff that really doesn't change much about the way things happen. But the way things have been for a long time is not necessarily that great. But on the other hand, formalizing, as the new laws do, formalizing the powers of the government, formalizing the requirements on ISPs to retain that information and provide it to the government, is an indication of the government's increasingly sort of cocky stance in relation to their ability to spy on you, which is essentially what it is. This is essentially spying on citizens. But for now, I'm just really focusing on this issue of journalists, because the question of the protection of journalists was one that came up early on, and it was seen as very important because, of course, journalists deal with sensitive information. They have sources who have to be protected in the public interest, because it's very important that information reaches the general public, correct? Well, as we've seen with the Snowden case, and as we've seen with Julian Assange, who've both been described as virtual traitors and criminals by both sides of politics in Australia, both of the major leading political parties have described Snowden and Assange as hardly worthy of any respect. And in the case of Snowden, he was described as a traitor by Tony Abbott. Now, in the case of Snowden, of course, yeah, he was a source. In the case of Assange was purportedly a journalist. But it's clear that there is a campaign to prosecute people like Assange to an equal degree that they would be prosecuting people like Edward Snowden. And when a news gathering organization like WikiLeaks comes along, which has very sophisticated techniques of acquiring information from sources, which goes to great lengths to protect those sources, and which has very, very advanced methods of kind of pumping that information out so that it can quickly saturate the news, this becomes a concern of the government to figure out, well, how are we going to stop this, right? So, again, getting back to the protections for journalists, I mean, there is no real protection here for journalist sources. There is protection for journalists in the sense that they've said, well, you've now got to get a warrant to access the metadata. But they don't need a warrant to access the metadata of a potential source. And if they already have someone under surveillance or are aware of someone on their radar who they think might be talking to a journalist, they can access the metadata of that target and find out whether that target's been talking to the journalist. And then they can probably get a warrant to access the journalist's information. That's just one scenario. But let's now just kind of step back from this a little and consider why it is that we're so preoccupied with journalists and we're not really worried about people accessing information from the average person or perhaps a lawyer or perhaps a doctor, right? And indeed, this can be very sensitive information. And just reading here from this article, theconversation.com, there are no safeguards proposed for other professionals who have traditionally enjoyed confidentiality around their communications, such as lawyers, medical practitioners, and even parliamentarians. Indeed, Communications Minister Malcolm Turnbull has termed journalists a special case when it comes to increased protection of their retained data. Nevertheless, the Law Institute of Victoria has again called for communications between lawyers and their clients to be exempted from the data retention proposals, and urged a warrant to be necessary for law enforcement to access these communications. So let's just think about it for a moment and think about why it is that we should only be concerned about journalists. I mean, surely we all have things that we want kept confidential for a variety of reasons. Why do journalists have the special protection? Why even should only lawyers have the special protection? And this takes us back to the heart of this whole dilemma, the heart of this whole crisis, which is that we have an expectation that we will be living in a society where we are not being spied on by anyone, whether it's your next door neighbour, whether it's a foreign power, or whether it's some government agency that wants to get some dirt on you. I mean, spying on people is not a nice thing to do, right? And most of us have no interest in spying on others. Most of us are busy with our lives. We have plenty to do. We have plenty to occupy ourselves with without wasting time prying into other people's affairs, right? And indeed, look, your next door neighbour might be a serial killer for all you know, right? It's possible. The society is full of criminals. You might be living next door to a serial killer. Now, does that mean that you should be entitled to set up a telescope and kind of like set up microphones so you can hear what your neighbour might be doing, just in case that neighbour of yours might be a criminal of some kind doing some horrendous crime? Of course not. It's rude, it's outrageous, it's ridiculous. And most people, you know, most people have better things to do with their time than do that. And I tell you what, the government and the police also have better things to do with their time than to randomly access people's metadata from ISPs. But of course the police will argue, well, we only do it when we need it, right? But then this definition of what they need and what is warranted depends on a mutually agreed and mutually accepted understanding of what the criteria for civilization is. The criteria for civilization that allows people their independence and their freedom. But when you have a civilization such as ours, where there are so many secrets being kept by the government and so many outright lies and such misinformation and crimes, I mean, we're talking about major crimes of state and state-sponsored terrorism and crimes of a colossal scale, such as the Iraq War and the war in Afghanistan and the bombing campaigns in Syria and the bombing campaigns that took part in Libya, where we have clear criminal illegality engaged on by the government. Boy, there is so much information out there that's going to be considered confidential, secret information by the government that's protected by laws which were never intended to protect criminals, but which people are going to be wanting to expose, right? And this is where the government's formalising and mandating their ability to access this information so that they can crush dissent needs to be understood for what it is, because it is about really crushing dissent. I mean, look what happened with the Edward Snowden affair. Look what happened with the Julian Assange affair. Julian Assange is still effectively in prison. Edward Snowden is in exile in Russia and under great threat of rendition, even from within Russia. But if he were to travel overseas, he's under great risk of rendition. Look what happened to Chelsea Manning. And this is just for revealing information which is in the public interest, which is not espionage, which is not revealing secrets to foreign powers to give them leverage or power over our country. With Truth News Radio Australia, we're going to break. I'll be continuing on this theme when we come back. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I've been talking today a little about data retention and surveillance and, you know, really just trying to drive home the point that that this is really all about you being spied on. And when they talk about how they're going to bring in some protection for some little group, this really only further highlights the fact that your rights are being breached. You know, this little group over here, they're going to be protected, but not you. You know, you might have some sensitive communications, but that's, sorry, you're just an average Joe citizen. You know, we'll just be able to access that. I mean, this is ridiculous, okay? But honestly, the access to metadata is just such a small amount of the information that they can really accept, that they can really access, that that the endless debate about it tends to be a bit of a smokescreen, because really the risks of powers that be, or nefarious powers generally, being able to get access to your information is astronomically higher than anyone's really talking about. And, you know, we don't really need to distinguish whether it's like the government or some other entities or agencies when we talk about the problem of our lack of security. I mean, in these new forms of legislation, ASIO basically has massive, massive powers to access the information. I mean, let me just explain this in a little more detail. I've got another article here from itwire.com. The legislation will include the creation of the position of a public interest advocate who will be able to argue against police access to a journalist's metadata for the purpose of identifying their sources. Now, the irony here is that this public interest advocate is also going to be a government employee. And this is really just going to be one department reporting to another department, and where one department is supposed to be you know, protecting your interests, the other department will be saying, well, no, we've actually got to get this information. I mean, wide door open there to corruption, and of course, a bloated bureaucracy as well, which is a waste of public money generally. But just continuing here, this means that in some cases, a judge will determine whether the public interest is served in the disclosure of the journalist's source. But agencies such as ASIO and ACES will not be subject to this constraint. Now, what this means, and indeed, there's a lot of obscurity and confusion in the exact meaning of this legislation, but it appears, and this is the way it's been reported by several sources, is that ASIO and ACES can basically do whatever they want. So it's kind of a bit of a joke when they talk about how they've given protection to journalists, because actually that protection doesn't protect them from ASIO at all, folks. It's all Orwellian babble, really. It's actually just that there needs to be another concept rather than double think or even double speak. It's just babble, a confusion of meaningless words to subjugate and pacify the voting public, to make them think that the government isn't quite as powerful and tyrannical as it clearly is. And that's why they just have all this babble about, we're going to have this protection, that protection, there's an exemption here, an exemption there, but there's an exemption to the exemption, and la-di-da-di-da. And really, the real game is somewhere else. The real game is that they've got vast access to information. I mean, ASIO is beyond the reach of most of the protections in law that we have. And believe me, they've got such amazing ability to access your private information that this is just a sideshow. This is a circus. And I want to now play to you a recent talk that was given at a TED conference from an IT security expert, which details some of this type of threat to our privacy, which is being conducted all over the world, and indeed governments of all stripes have been involved in breaching people's private information in this way. So just continuing here now, playing you a clip from a TED conference here.
The 2011 Arab Spring captured the attention of the world. It also captured the attention...
Just pausing, this is Christopher Sogyan, a security specialist.
...tension of authoritarian governments in other countries who were worried that revolution would spread. To respond, they ramped up surveillance of activists, journalists, and dissidents who they feared would inspire revolution in their own countries. One prominent Bahraini activist who was arrested and tortured by his government has said that the interrogators showed him transcripts of his telephone calls and text messages. Of course, it's no secret that governments are able to intercept telephone calls and text messages. It's for that reason that many activists specifically avoid using the telephone. Instead, they use tools like Skype, which they think are immune to interception. They're wrong. There have now been, over the last few years, an industry of companies who provide surveillance technology to governments, specifically technology that allows those governments to hack into the computers of surveillance targets. Rather than intercepting the communications as they go over the wire, instead they now hack into your computer, enable your webcam, enable your microphone, and steal documents from your computer. When the government of Egypt fell in 2011, activists raided the office of the secret police, and among the many documents they found was this document by the Gamma Corporation, by Gamma International. Gamma is a German company that manufactures surveillance software and sells it only to governments. It's important to note that most governments don't really have the in-house capabilities to develop this software. Smaller ones don't have the resources or the expertise. And so there's this market of Western companies who are happy to supply them with the tools and techniques for a price. Gamma is just one of these companies. I should note also that Gamma never actually sold their software to the Egyptian government. They'd sent them an invoice for a sale, but the Egyptians never bought it. Instead, apparently, the Egyptian government used a free demo version of Gamma's software. So this screenshot is from a sales video that Gamma produced. Really, they're just emphasizing in a relatively slick presentation the fact that the police can sort of sit in an air-conditioned office and remotely monitor someone without them having any idea that's going on. You know, your webcam light won't turn on. There's nothing to indicate that the microphone is enabled. This is the managing director of Gamma International. His name is Martin Munch. There are many photos of Mr. Munch that exist. This is perhaps my favorite. I'm just going to zoom in a little bit onto his webcam. You can see there's a little sticker that's placed over his camera. He knows what kind of surveillance is possible, and so clearly he doesn't want it to be used against him. Munch has said that he intends for his software to be used to capture terrorists and locate pedophiles. Of course, he's also acknowledged that once the software has been sold to governments, he has no way of knowing how it can be used. Gamma's software has been located on servers in countries around the world, many with really atrocious track records in human rights violations. They really are selling their software around the world. Gamma is not the only company in the business. As I said, it's a $5 billion industry. One of the other big guys in the industry is an Italian company called Hacking Team. Now, Hacking Team has what is probably the slickest presentation. The video they've produced is very sexy, and so I'm going to play you a clip just so you can get a feel both for the capabilities of the software, but also how it's marketed to their government clients.
You want to look through your target's eyes. You have to hack your target. You have to hit many different platforms. You have to overcome encryption and capture relevant data. Stealth and untraceable. Deployed all over your country. Exactly what we do.
So it would be funny if it wasn't true, but in fact, Hacking Team software is being sold to governments around the world. Last year, we learned, for example, that it's been used to target Moroccan journalists by the Moroccan government. Many countries it's been found in.
You're with Truth News Radio Australia. I'm playing to you a clip here from security specialists talking about some of the amazing off-the-shelf technology for spying. that's being used by governments, including the Australian government. Showed up on the map there of the countries that are using it. We're just going to break. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I've been playing to you a clip here from security specialist Christopher Sogian describing some commercial software that that has been used. It was used by the Egyptian government. Apparently, they downloaded a demo version. And used that to gain very detailed access to the people they were spying on, which were basically political activists. And this indeed highlights a point I was making earlier, which is that one of the main reasons why governments want to spy on you historically has been that they're trying to shut down dissent. And, you know, when governments justify their power or give themselves increased powers, or when you discover that they have all these powers that you didn't even know about, for them to take the line that, hey, look, we're only interested in catching criminals and so-called terrorists, it's just such a lame argument, folks. I mean, come on. I mean, how naive have we become? Because I know that most of the people in this country, most of the people in Australia go along with this bullshit, right? They actually go along with this idea that the government is really just, you know, just wants to catch criminals. And criminals are defined as like bad people who steal things or hurt other people or, you know, drug dealers or, you know, terrorists, you know. And then we don't even have any terrorism in this country. I mean, all the terrorism that we have is either completely phony stuff, completely fake stuff, like the guy in the chocolate shop who clearly wasn't a terrorist and was clearly being puppeted by some agencies. You know, I did a show on that a few months ago, but I mean, the chocolate shop is now regarded as one of Australia's great moments of terrorism, and clearly this guy was just some unhinged patsy. We don't have terrorism in this country. We have people going off to fight in conflicts in Syria, which our government has helped to create. But there is a great fear among the ruling elite all over the world that all of their lies and all their deceptions and all their criminality will be exposed. And that's what they're trying to protect themselves against most. So just to continue, as you listen to this talk, which is talking about rogue governments in other countries, your own government is a rogue government, folks. And it doesn't matter, I don't care who's in charge. It doesn't matter who's in charge, the whole system is corrupt and rogue. So we'll just now continue with that clip from the TED speech. Here we go.
So Hacking Team has also been actively courting the U.S. law enforcement market. In the last year or so, the company has often opened a sales office in Virginia or in Maryland. The company's also hired a spokesperson. They've been attending surveillance industry conferences where law enforcement officials show up. They've spoken at the conferences. What I thought was most fascinating was they've actually paid for the coffee break at one of the law enforcement conferences earlier this year. I can't tell you for sure that Hacking Team has sold their technology in the United States. But what I can tell you is that they haven't sold it. It isn't because they haven't been trying hard. So as I said before, governments that don't really have the resources to build their own tools will buy off-the-shelf surveillance software. And so for that reason, you see that the government of, say, Tunisia might use the same software as the government of Germany. They're all buying off-the-shelf stuff. The Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States does have the budget to build their own surveillance technology. And so for several years, I've been trying to figure out if and how the FBI is hacking into the computers of surveillance targets. My friends at an organization called the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they're a civil society group, obtained hundreds of documents from the FBI detailing their next generation of surveillance technologies. Most of these documents were heavily redacted, but what you can see from the slide if I zoom in, is this term remote operations unit. Now, when I first looked into this, I'd never heard of this unit before. I've been studying surveillance for more than 6 years. I'd never heard of it. And so I went online and I did some research, and ultimately I hit the mother load when I went to LinkedIn, the social networking site for job seekers. There were lots of former U.S. government contractors who had at one point worked for the remote operating unit and were describing in surprising detail on their CVs what they had done in their former job. So I took this information and I gave it to a journalist that I know and trust at the Wall Street Journal, and she was able to contact several other former law enforcement officials who spoke on background and confirmed that, yes, in fact, the FBI has a dedicated team that does nothing but hack into the computers of surveillance targets. Like Gamma and Hacking Team, the FBI also has the capability to remotely activate webcams, microphones, steal documents, get web browsing information, the works. There's sort of a big problem with governments going into hacking, and that's that terrorists, pedophiles, drug dealers, journalists, and human rights activists all use the same kinds of computers. There's no drug dealer phone, and there's no journalist laptop. We all use the same technology. And what that means, then, is that for governments to have the capability to hack into the computers of the real bad guys, they also have to have the capability to hack into our devices, too. So governments around the world have been embracing this technology, they've been embracing hacking as a law enforcement technique, but without any real debate. In the United States, where I live, there have been no congressional hearings. There's no law that's been passed specifically authorizing this technique. And because of its power and potential for abuse, it's vital that we have an informed public debate. Thank you very much.
Okay, I just want to read to you now a short excerpt from an Australian blog, The Angry Aussie. He's also got a YouTube channel, which is quite interesting. He's a very articulate guy. And I just want to read some points that he makes on his blog about this whole issue. And this is more of a general perspective on it. Historically, police power has always been abused. This is not an argument for the elimination of police, but it is an argument for oversight and limits to their power. Spying is worse than policing. By its very nature, it is difficult to control. If people have the power to declare that something is in the national interest and top secret, who is in a position to make sure that they don't abuse their power? Recent history with whistleblowers revealing government surveillance that goes well beyond the law have shown that embarrassing a government invites massive retaliation. Manning in military prison, Snowden hiding in Russia, Assange hiding in the Ecuadorian embassy, exposing government malfeasance can pretty much put an end to any sort of ordinary life. Even on a smaller scale, on top of the inherent wrongness of the American surveillance system, it's been shown to have been abused repeatedly in trivial ways, with operators regularly using it to invade the privacy of exes or even complete strangers they were just interested in. And those are just the ones we know about. Are you going to tell me there aren't some programmers out there using the systems to try and spy on celebrities just for giggles? And for those delightfully naive people who say you have nothing to fear if you haven't done anything wrong, you are living in a privileged delusion. You have nothing to fear up until someone in power wants to hurt you. And you don't have to break the law for that to happen. You just have to represent something they don't like. You might rightly think the current regime is your friend and they'd never do that to you. But nobody stays in power forever. Sooner or later, someone who is fundamentally opposed to your views will be in power. And these laws will still be in place, but different people with different priorities and different standards will be wielding them. You can't get a clearer example of this than the number of conservative governments around Australia who have set up independent commissions to investigate corruption because they were rightly sure the opposing Labor Party was guilty of all sorts of corruption. Then they get awfully surprised when the commission exercises its independence and investigates corruption among the conservatives. If you want to know if a law can be abused, imagine your worst enemy having the power to use it against you. Do you still feel safe? If you're still clinging to "I don't break the law," just think, have I ever come into contact with a total douchebag in my life? The police service, spy agencies and politicians have a disturbing tendency to contain a greater percentage of douchebags than the general population. If one of them has decided they don't like you and want to damage your reputation, they can trawl through your communications records until they find something to smear you with. And even if you think there's nothing in your internet history that can hurt you, I think you're lying, by the way, they only need to create the impression of impropriety to do damage. In these situations, I'm always reminded of the words of Cardinal Richelieu. Give me 6 lines written by the hand of the most honest man, I would find something in them to have him hanged. If authorities want to convict you of something, they almost invariably will. Innocence is a matter of perception, not objective truth. Sure, it's brown people who have to worry most now. But if you think this idea of government having unlimited warrantless access to your communications metadata is no big deal, you deserve what comes next. And I think an important point to highlight here is that, you see, for people who have absolutely no interest in social activism, for people who just accept the status quo, just watch TV and go shopping and go to work and just blindly suck up whatever propaganda is given to them and never complain, you know what? Most of those people aren't going to be targeted by the police. But the moment someone steps up, the moment someone does take an interest, the moment someone becomes an activist of any kind, and you can easily become an activist even without having any background in it. You might just have the bad luck to be living next to a coal seam gas oil well, or you might be affected by some council rulings or some pollution issues in your neighbourhood, and suddenly there you are, you know, suddenly you're an activist. And suddenly the police might be interested in you. And you, the person who thought that it didn't matter, you didn't care, you had nothing to hide, well, they might just find some little bit of information about you that's embarrassing to you, you know? Maybe you call an escort agency. The more prominent you become, the more a target you become for the access of vital, sensitive information, whether it's of criminal nature or not. And the more corrupt society becomes, the more this will happen. And of course, then we move into a situation of turmoil and revolution, which is pretty much where we're headed. That is the end of the show for today. Second hour will be a repeat of one of our recent interviews. I'm hoping to come back in next week with some great interview topics. See you then.